WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, WRFN Nashville, KRBS Oroville, The Surge 96.3, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, or WMRW Warren.
To the rich man's bright lodges, I ride in this wind. On my good horse, I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You know, the media is the problem. It's a problem. But again, let's just talk about we the people. What is the media but a reflection of the needs and wants and desires of the consumer? After all, don't we want our news spoon-fed to us? Don't we insist that the evening news come in 30-minute segments? 15 of those are commercials. We get a little bored if the sound bite's longer than 30 seconds. We get really bored if the in-depth story's longer than 3 minutes. You know, we want to be entertained. That's why the news budgets of major corporations have been shrunk. We're more interested, the collective we, are more interested in reality TV. American Idol. I mean, did Phoebe get voted off last night? I mean, did she? I mean, let's everybody talk about that. It's stunning. I go to Monday Night Football. I'm a big football fan. I go with my friends. We go out, drink a couple beers, and we watch football. And these are my same friends who are like, Scott, man, we support you a lot. You know, thank you for doing what you're doing. But it's just too complicated, man. We can't get into this stuff. I mean, you've got all this data. We don't have it. We can't get it. The media won't give it to us. We're so sorry. Hey, look, number 23. It's 3rd and 2. He has a 17.5% chance, if he goes over the left tackle, of making the yards. How did you know that? Well, he read the sports page. He's got this much Sports Illustrated. The guy studies the topic. You know, baseball, the Yankees come up. I guarantee you, a true Yankees fan will give you the slugging percentages of every player, what their base stealing rate is, what their on-base average is. How do they know this? They study it. Well, if you put half the time you put into studying sports statistics and to studying what's going on with your country, you might be a little bit more empowered to make decisions. No, I blame the media, but I blame us. I blame us. The data is there. The New York Times... You know, I think one of the things we found with the New York Times is that it's no longer the paper of record. No newspaper should be. The second we say that our ability to comprehend and ascertain what's going on in the world is held hostage to a single source or a group of sources, is the day we might as well throw our hands up and surrender. The New York Times can't give us all the answers. Neither can CNN. Neither can ABC, neither can CBS. It's not about a single source. It's about the 6 inches between these two earlobes and making those work. There's data out there. It's on the internet. It's in newspapers. But when you read a newspaper, you got to understand, you got to put your bias filter on. You understand they're not going to give you absolute fact, absolute certainty. You're going to have to work. We're all going to have to work. Democracy is an ugly, ugly process. It's hard. It's not easy. It requires us to work. And one of the key aspects is to remember that the media is not going to do the job for us. The media, for the most part, is corporate owned. It's a business. It derives its income from advertisements. Advertisements are based upon viewership. And unfortunately, the viewership in America would rather watch an hour and a half solid of American Idol than 5 minutes of an in-depth study about what's going on in Iraq. So the media is not going to solve any of our problems.
That was an excerpt from a recent talk in Binghamton, New York, by former UN weapons inspector Scott Ritter. I hope to have the full speech for you at a later date, but I played that clip because it's apropos to this week's program. Ritter just asserted that media programming is stupid and trivial because it is responding to the desires of a population obsessed with consumerism and trivia. That may now be the case, but it was not always that way. A century ago, so-called ordinary people, farmers, factory workers, small business owners, tradespeople, used to turn up by the thousands to hear political speakers and debate topics that are now considered the exclusive province of pundits. Topics such as corporate subsidies and the banking system. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. In 1892, the People's Party, also known as the Populists, held its founding convention in Omaha, Nebraska. Their platform contained these paragraphs. We meet in the midst of a nation brought to the verge of moral, political, and material ruin. Corruption dominates the ballot box, the legislatures, the Congress, and touches even the ermine of the bench. The people are demoralized, and most of the states have been compelled to isolate the voters at the polling places to prevent universal intimidation and bribery. The newspapers are largely subsidized or muzzled, public opinion silenced, business prostrated, homes covered with mortgages, labor impoverished, and the land concentrating in the hands of capitalists. The urban workmen are denied the right to organize for self-protection. Imported, pauperized labor beats down their wages. A hireling standing army, unrecognized by our laws, is established to shoot them down, and they are rapidly degenerating into European conditions. The fruits of the toil of millions are badly stolen to build up colossal fortunes for a few, unprecedented in the history of mankind, and the possessors of these in turn despise the republic and endanger liberty. From the same prolific womb of governmental injustice we breed the two great classes, tramps and millionaires. Well, the press may have been muzzled, but apparently not muzzled enough. A mere 9 months later, in the national election of 1892, the People's Party received over 1 million votes of the 12 million cast, elected a few members to Congress, and carried enough states to garner 22 electoral votes. There have always been ignorant people in America, but it was not a point of pride. This trivial, gleefully ignorant, and self-absorbed national mindset was deliberately nurtured in the 20th century, and swept across the land in the perfect storm of the Cold War, McCarthyism, and the emergence of mass media. Suppressing democracy in the interests of corporate profits and elite rule is the founding purpose, as we will hear, of the public relations industry. John Stauber is an investigative writer on the managing of public opinion. His many books include Toxic Sludge is Good for You, Trust Us, We're Experts, and Weapons of Mass Deception. He spoke recently at Ithaca College about the latest developments in the propaganda industry. He's introduced by Diane Lynch, Dean of the Park School of Communications.
We have a wonderful speaker. I couldn't be happier to have the privilege to introduce to you John Stauber. Many of you are familiar with his work. I have to explain that I'm from Madison, Wisconsin, and John is from Wisconsin, and I just told him he's a Midwesterner at heart. He just came up to me and said, keep the introduction short. And I said, you can come here anytime you want. So I will do that. I will honor the request and keep the introduction short. I was going to read you all of the book titles. I'll hold them up. John is an author. He is an investigative reporter and writer. He is the founder and the director of the nonprofit Center for Media and Democracy. He's the editor of its quarterly news magazine, PR Watch, has been doing that since 1993. He is a public speaker, as you will see very shortly, I'm sure. The range of his experience, his contributions to our democracy, to high-quality, profound, and responsible journalism, the list is long. And he's here today to speak with us not only about democracy, but about the role of the media within it. Please join me in welcoming him to the Park School.
I'm from Madison, Wisconsin, and we sort of like to call ourselves the Ithaca of the Midwest. If you've ever been to Madison, it's sort of a similar college town, very progressive, liberal, lots of great stuff happening, and Ithaca certainly has that reputation. I'm looking forward to spending a little more time here tomorrow. Let me just explain a little bit about my organization, Center for Media and Democracy. I don't come out of journalism. I don't come out of public relations. I don't have a background in academia. I've been fortunate enough ever since high school, when I was an anti-Vietnam War activist, and we shut down my high school in Mel Laird's hometown, Nixon's Secretary of Defense, in 1970 to organize the first Earth Day. I come out of a background of activism, and I've been very fortunate my entire life to always be able to work on issues that matter to me, social justice issues, consumer issues, say food issues, issues of war and peace. I met my co-author, Sheldon Rampton, in 1985 when we were both working with Wisconsin Coordinating Council on Nicaragua. And it was in 1988 when my friend Jeremy Rifkin asked me to organize farmers and consumers against Monsanto's genetically engineered cow hormone that I really began to learn about the public relations industry. And, of course, public relations is, you know, actually it's a euphemism for propaganda. And it was a term coined by Eddie Bernays, the father of the public relations industry, because in the United States and Western democracies, we're supposed to believe we don't have propaganda. Propaganda is a dirty term. It's a pejorative that connotes Stalin's Russia or Hitler's Germany. We have, you know, well-educated, skeptical to the point of cynical citizenry. We have an independent, investigative, free press. And certainly, if there were any organization or cabal or conspiracy or governmental or corporate entity intent on managing our perceptions through propaganda, we'd all know about it. Of course, the irony is, as Alex Carey pointed out and other academics who've made it a point of studying propaganda, that it's actually in countries like the United States where we have the most propaganda. Because in brutal dictatorships, whether it's, you know, Saddam's Iraq or Guatemala after the U.S. overthrew the government in 1954, or whether we're talking Stalin's Russia or Hitler's Germany, absolute brutal oppression works pretty well to control the populace. It's really in countries like ours where you need a very sophisticated, hidden method of persuasion and control. And in fact, here in the United States, it's become a huge business, advertising and especially the hidden manipulation of public relations. The gentleman I mentioned, Alex Carey, isn't known to most Americans. He really wasn't known to me until a friend of mine, Bob McChesney, gave me a book of Alex Carey's that's now available in the U.S. It wasn't yet then, titled Taking the Risk Out of Democracy. And Carey was a friend and a collaborator with Noam Chomsky, who was an Australian, and he studied corporate propaganda. And Alex Carey wrote something in this posthumously published book that I think really is a touchstone. It's a touchstone for our work, but I think it also, when you hear it, you'll see that it's a touchstone for really comprehending what's going on right now in our world. Carey wrote, "The 20th century has been characterized by three developments of great political importance: the growth of democracy, the growth of corporate power, and the growth of corporate propaganda as a means of protecting corporate power against democracy." And then he went on to explain how, in a democracy, it's advertising, but especially public relations, through which propaganda is waged. So when I was asked by my friend Jeremy Rifkin to get involved in this effort around bovine growth hormone, it was obvious to me that companies like Monsanto that were developing this drug were colluding with the Food and Drug Administration and the U.S. Department of Agriculture, the regulatory agencies that supposedly protect animal health and protect food safety, and that rather than investigating this drug and regulating it or keeping it off the market as they should have done, they were helping Monsanto and the other firms promote the drug. And I did a Freedom of Information Act investigation that got for me thousands of pages of internal documents, mind-blowing, showing, for instance, that the American Medical Association and the American Dietetic Association had already been brought into this campaign to front for this drug even before it was approved. At the same time, I got a call from a very nice woman who said she heard that I was organizing a meeting in Washington, D.C. of groups who were concerned about bovine growth hormone. And she was with a group called Maryland Citizens Consumer Council. And would they be able to come to the meeting? They were housewives. They had kids. And they didn't want their kids drinking milk from cows injected with this drug. They wanted them to be able to choose in the marketplace and not have to drink it in schools if it were approved. So I invited her to, of course, participate. We had our meeting, and there were groups like Consumers Union and National Farmers Union, National Family Farm Coalition, some state legislators. A couple weeks later, and this was in October 1990, I got a call from John Dillon, who's still a reporter in Vermont, and he said, you know, Monsanto's bragging that they had a spy in your meeting. Any idea who that might be? And, of course, I knew who it was right away. It was this wonderful young woman, Diane Moser, because she was the only person who wasn't known to us. So I did some sleuthing and discovered that, indeed, Diane Moser, unlike another person from her group who contacted us, was her real name. And she and the other person both worked for the Burson Marsteller public relations firm. The Maryland Citizens Consumer Council didn't exist. And Burson Marsteller, one of the world's largest PR firms, was employed by Monsanto and the other companies developing this drug. And she was essentially a spy to infiltrate our meeting and report back. And, of course, I was outraged. And then in the documents I was obtaining under the Freedom of Information Act, I was finding that another firm called Direct Impact did a similar sort of spy operation with money from the USDA to discredit a farmer-organized conference in New York. And I was just blown away. And I realized, there's something wrong here. So I began to investigate, and what really dawned on me was that this is how every single important issue is managed by firms we've never heard of, like Burson Marsteller, Hill & Knowlton, Edelman. And Burson Marsteller, I've learned quite a bit about, a very interesting company. For instance, when the Argentine junta was flying people out into the ocean and pushing them drugged out of planes, it was Burson Marsteller's job to whitewash the image of that junta internationally so they wouldn't be seen as the brutal regime they were. Burson Marsteller is one of the premier public relations firms in the world. And they like to call what they do perception management. And they say that their job is managing public policy, public issues, public opinion, and public perception on behalf of their clients, the biggest corporations and government agencies in the world. So I determined that I would do something about this. I mean, we should be depending upon journalists in America to investigate and report on propaganda campaigns. But one of the ironies of the news media in the United States is that rather than investigate and aggressively report on propaganda campaigns, journalists are at least as likely to simply pass on the propaganda. And today in the United States, there are more people working in the business of public relations, mostly for corporations, also government agencies, than there are working journalists in the country. And the largest single source of public relations people are journalists. And who better to manipulate and manage the news than people who come out of journalism? And, you know, I think this problem of confusing journalism and propaganda really begins in journalism classrooms. Because what's happened is that as media has conglomerated, and the conglomeration has gotten to the point where when I started this organization 13 years ago, there were something like 25 companies that owned and controlled the magazine, newspaper, radio, TV, broadcast industry. Now we're down to what, half a dozen? As that's happened, journalism has slid downhill into deep demise. And companies that are trying to milk more and more money out of the news media that they own have been laying off real journalists. There's tremendous self-censorship in journalism. Most Americans get most of their information from TV, which is absolutely the worst source of information. And in fact, when you're looking at television, a lot of what you're thinking is news is actually fake news. It's video news releases, anywhere from 4,000 to 8,000 video news releases. They look like news programs. They're produced by journalists. But the journalists are now working for firms like Burson Marsteller and Doug Simon and others on behalf of clients like Philip Morris and Exxon and clients like Monsanto. And they're providing these three-minute news stories and the B-roll that goes with it to every single TV network and station in the country on locked sites. You can't get in. I can't get in. I can't break into these stream of VNRs. But every news broadcaster in the country can. And yet in the 25 years that video news releases have been a staple, what happens is the TV news simply downloads these and airs these biased, slanted reports paid for by a government agency or more likely a corporation as real news stories. I can't, you know, break into that stream of thousands of video news releases, but every TV journalist in the country, certainly every news producer, could. And yet in the 25 years that these video news releases have been developed and used, the greatest ongoing plagiarism scandal in American media, I am not aware of a single instance where one TV network, news director, or station took one of these phony news stories and did a story on it, exposing it. They either use them as news, as if they did it, or they don't air them at all. And, you know, think of this. I've been talking with PR and journalism students today, and as I was saying in Michelle Berry's class, if an assignment were given this semester, you're going to come in and you're going to hand in a 2 or 3 minute news story on any subject, and you handed in your news story, and it were just wonderful, great TV journalism, and you got an A, great. But then if somebody said, oh, you know, Billy didn't do a thing. That news story was handed to Billy. He just handed it in to you and got the A. Hopefully you'd be kicked out of class. Maybe you'd be kicked out of school. The irony is that when you graduate and you go into so-called TV journalism, what you do is you download video news releases and you air them on your station as if they're real news. I mean, seriously, thousands a year. And this is where most Americans get most of their news. And ironically, when Americans are asked, what news do you trust most? It's local TV news, where this is the most used. With the help of the Park Foundation, my organization for the past year has done the most in-depth investigation ever into the use of video news releases. And next month in Washington, we're going to be releasing the results of this study. And it's really astounding. I have to tell you, it's even worse than I thought it was. What's going to be fun about this is that working with our partner Free Press last May, we were able to get the FCC to open a docket and receive comments on this problem, the Federal Communications Commission. And among those comments were comments from the Radio and TV News Directors Association, the trade association for TV journalists. And they totally ridiculed the idea that anyone in the profession was doing this. In fact, the head of the association said, oh, TV fake news, video news releases, this is like the Loch Ness Monster, she said. People keep thinking they see it, but it isn't really out there. Well, next month, the Loch Ness Monster is going to make an appearance in Washington, and it's going to be very interesting. When I was asked to title this talk, I spit out a title, What's Reality? You know, going back to my Firesign Theater days. And subtitled it, Fake News, Real News, and Weapons of Mass Perception. What I've just described you know, is one example of fake news. It's incredibly egregious. But I think maybe the biggest problem we have in our country has just been revealed by what we've seen since 9/11, when the American mainstream news media, rather than questioning the Bush administration's march to war in Iraq, became like an official propaganda arm of that administration, and for the most part, echoed and echoed the rationale for war, and kept out of the media, for the most part and overwhelmingly, people who were critical of the march to war. You know, when the United States attacked Iraq, if you looked at opinion on whether or not that war should be launched, the United States was like an island. In Mexico, in Canada, in Britain, in Germany, in France, in Japan, name your favorite Western ally, the overwhelming majority of people in those countries were opposed to attacking Iraq. Here in the United States, there was massive opposition to attacking Iraq, despite the fact that U.S. media censored out credible critics of the war. Oh, sure, you could find Janine Garofalo, you could find Tim Robbins, you could find Susan Sarandon, and God bless them. They were very articulate and very brave, and they were vilified, and they risked their careers, people like George Clooney, and there were right-wing attack campaigns against them. But as Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting has shown, most of the public affairs programs, most of the reporting in this country was very pro-war. There was an exception on television, and it was an important exception, and that was the Phil Donahue show on MSNBC. But 3 years ago, just before the launch of the war, MSNBC dumped that program. And at the time, they said they were getting rid of the program because no one watched it. However, as the New York Times pointed out, actually, the Donahue show was attracting more viewers than was their premier public affairs program, Hardball with Chris Matthews. More faces glued to the tube watching Phil Donahue. So what are they doing? MSNBC needs the money. What were they doing axing that program? Well, a memo came out in which the reason for getting rid of Phil Donahue was revealed. An NBC report recommended getting rid of Donahue because he presented, quote, a difficult public face for NBC in a time of war. He seemed to delight in presenting guests who are anti-war, anti-Bush, and, God forbid, skeptical of the administration's motives. And the report went on to outline what Sheldon and I described as a true nightmare scenario for NBC, where the show becomes, according to this memo, quote, a home for the liberal anti-war agenda, at the same time that our competitors are waving the flag at every opportunity. So there you go. The one program that was attracting viewership, that was having some impact perhaps on public opinion, that was daring to stand up to what we all recognize now were the false and deceptive claims of the administration, was kicked off the air because MSNBC needed to compete with Fox, which had wrapped itself in the flag and really was leading the cheerleading for the war, so much so that within the TV media, it was called the Fox Effect, and it was driving everyone into that you-rah-rah attack Iraq camp. Exactly 3 years ago, Sheldon and I got a call from our editor, Mitch Horowitz at Penguin, major corporate publisher, part of the Pearson conglomerate, and we're happy to have him publish our books. And Mitch called and he said, look, you know, you've been reporting in PR Watch and on your website about how this war is being deceptively sold and the whole PR campaign around it. Would you want to do a book on that? And we said, absolutely. I said, I've even got a title. We'll call it Weapons of Mass Deception. And he said, great, great. He said, here's the thing. You have to write the book in 6 weeks because we want this book on the shelves in July. We want this to be the first book out the chute that's actually confronting this war. And he said, of course, we want to sell books. And, you know, they're a very careful mainstream publisher, careful in their marketing. And this book wasn't going to have any time for a marketing campaign. But he said, that's not a problem because you guys are going to be beat up. O'Reilly's going to kick your butt around his soundstage. Scarborough's going to want you on. You're going to be just vilified because I know what you're going to write. And that's going to be great because you'll hold your own, you'll get to argue, and we're going to sell some books. How does it sound? So we said, great, sounds great. And it did, and it does. So we, 3 years ago, actually did deliver our book, Weapons of Mass Deception, The Uses of Propaganda in Bush's War in Iraq. And the reason we were able to write a book in 6 weeks is because of all the online reporting we'd been doing. It was a matter of taking what we'd already written, writing some more, and putting it into a book. The book was published July 28, 2003. We were flown out to New York, and believe me, Penguin did everything it could possibly do to flack us. They worked really hard, and what was amazing was no one would have us on. Scarborough, O'Reilly, no one. This outrageous book that claimed, when the war still looked like a good idea, that there was no connection between Saddam and 9/11. There was no connection between Saddam and Al-Qaeda terrorists. Saddam was not a threat regionally and certainly not internationally. And there almost certainly was no active weapons of mass destruction campaign. No one wanted to interview us except for Democracy Now! And French TV, and God bless them, and Fairness and Accuracy in reporting their program, their radio program. Despite that media blackout on our book, it was by far and away our best-selling book. It was simultaneously published in Australia and Britain. It was the best book, best-selling book in Britain on the Iraq War. And it bounced for about 8 weeks, as I remember, between like 17 and 30 on the New York Times bestseller nonfiction paperback list. Not that the New York Times ever reviewed it. It was reviewed by the San Francisco Chronicle, and it was an Amazon bestseller. And, of course, authors love to whine. They love to whine about their publisher, about their failure to get reviews, about how the reviews are lousy when they get them. We couldn't complain too much because it was our best-selling book. It sold, I don't know, over 100,000 copies so far. But my point is that even in July of 2003, a book like this was persona non grata in mainstream media. That cone of silence, that censorship, that rally around the Bush administration that marched us into that war was still happening. Now, of course, things are very different. But why was public opinion so different in Mexico, Canada, Britain, Australia, Germany, Italy? I mean, there's Berlusconi, Rupert Murdoch is everywhere. Media conglomeration is an international global business. And yet, at least in those other countries, you don't have a situation where the left liberal side of the political spectrum is shut out of public debate. And you don't have a situation where critics of the war are kept off of MSNBC's, are kept off TV to the point where MSNBC is willing to dump its most watched public affairs program because, God forbid, they should look like they're pro-terrorist or something. So when you look at how do we get into this mess in Iraq, and that's the book of ours that's coming out in September. It's titled The Best War Ever, Lies, Damn Lies, and the Mess in Iraq. You can blame the Bush administration, but you also have to blame their PR partners in the mainstream media. And it's really fascinating to watch it, really, what's going on in the mainstream media. Tori Clark is out on book tour right now. I haven't had time to read her book. I think it's called Lipstick on a Pig. But really interesting person. You know, she ran Hillel Knowlton's Washington office. Hillel Knowlton used to be a competitor of Burson Marsteller. They were like the world's two or three biggest PR firms. Now they're under the same roof because these mergers have also taken place in the propaganda world. If you run Hillel Knowlton's Washington office, you know, one of their biggest accounts was the first Gulf War for Kuwait. They ran with $11 million of royal family money from Kuwait, Citizens for a Free Kuwait. Still a good idea, Free Kuwait, by the way. Citizens for a Free Kuwait, and made sure that the United States went to war that time around. And however you think of that war, the idea that a PR firm, Burson Marsteller, got $11 million and staged what looked like a congressional hearing in Washington this story about baby killing by Iraqi soldiers in Kuwait to gain airtime during the crucial last days of the debate on whether or not the Senate was going to support that war should just put chills up and down your back. That's the Hillel Knowlton firm. Tori Clark ran their Washington office, and, you know, if you're running the Washington office, you know where the bodies are buried. She's very effective, very good, very Republican. She was brought in to the Bush administration. She was Donald Rumsfeld's PR person. She invented the concept, brilliant PR, of embedding U.S. soldiers with the troops in the attack on Iraq. And by June or July, she left that job, and guess where she went? Into the media. She worked for CNN, where I think she still is, as a commentator. And now she's out on book tour, and I've caught her interviewed. She's been interviewed on The Daily Show, all over the place. And the gist of her book is spin doesn't work because everyone is so smart, everyone is so cynical, that now all this public relations stuff that she excels in simply doesn't work anymore, which is just one of the best PR spins out there by the PR industry. So I'm sort of droning on here. But when you write five books, you got a lot of material, so you tend to drone. I want to go to Q&A, and I just want to make a couple points. So I'm going to short-circuit it here. One point I want to make is that it's really, really possible to be really, really depressed about the state of journalism, reporting, the news media in the United States. There are very good reasons for that, and probably no one is more depressed than the people inside journalism who are really working hard to be journalists. Journalism is a sacred trust. You cannot have a functioning, healthy democracy without a courageous, independent, hard-charging, investigative press. It is impossible, which explains a lot about what's wrong right now with our democracy. And when I come to campuses and talk to journalism students and public relations students, I find a certain attitude, which I haven't stumbled on here yet, among some people, usually people who teach public relations and journalism. And this is what they'll say. Well, at our school, we've merged together journalism and public relations. Because after all, it's the same skills. You've got to be able to investigate. You've got to be able to talk on camera. You've got to be able to write. You've got to be able to research. There's really no difference between the skills you need to be a journalist and the skills you need to be good in public relations. And so we've merged them all together here on our campus. And what I say is, well, that's really interesting. That's sort of like saying, you know, there's really no difference between the skills you need to be an incredible accountant and the skills you need to be the best embezzler in the world. There's really no difference. You got to know numbers. You got to be able to work them, manage them, report. And so we've, And then, of course, this was before we found out about Enron and that that's really true. There is no difference anymore. But my point is that I think journalism students should certainly take PR courses. And it's fine if PR students take journalism courses. But there should be a real clear understanding that journalism is a sacred trust. It's essential to a democracy. You cannot have a functioning democracy if you've got a mainstream media that, when the chips are down, lays off real journalists and echoes the lies of an administration that's hell-bent on going to war despite what they know and despite the facts. You know, I can't point to anything more than this incredible mess in Iraq that is going to affect our world and our lives for as long as all of us live as an example of why do we need to really revive, revitalize, and reclaim journalism. And what I would say is that as desperate as things appear, there's also a shining bright light, a flame, and it's growing brighter. And I believe it's this. If we can succeed, and this will not be easy, if we can succeed in protecting the freedom of the web and the internet and even expanding that to encourage more and more independent journalism and reporting online, if we can cause to flourish and grow more organizations like those that make up the association, the Action Coalition for Media Education, ACME, a really great coalition of real media literacy groups that is meeting in October in Vermont. If we can convince more foundations to move money into independent journalism so that the news media isn't bought and paid for by the Fortune 500, who are not going to allow stories they don't like to be routinely aired. If we can create more and more flowering of the sort of independent media we're seeing coming forth, then we are actually going to pull back from this precipice and have a flowering of critical thinking, access to information, and real journalism. In our book, Banana Republicans, How the Right Wing is Turning America into a One-Party State, we looked for hopeful signs. And one of the most hopeful signs we found was the political opening and liberalization that's occurred in South Korea. And if you look at what's happened in South Korea, the reason that South Korea has gone from a very repressive, controlled society to a very open society is the internet. In South Korea, there's more access to high-speed, online, in homes per capita than anywhere else in the world. I'm not saying everything about that is good, but one thing that's good about it is it enabled a politically progressive businessman in South Korea to come up with this brilliant idea called Oh My News. And he really launched what I think is the most successful citizen journalism experiment in the world because it opened up and changed the government of South Korea. What he did was he married together good journalists with literally thousands of trained citizen journalists who are the eyes and ears on the ground. And the reporting is done online. And so South Koreans turned away from what they knew was censored, controlled, unobjective, biased media reporting on TV and in papers to Oh My News online. And that made all the difference. We don't have anything like that in the United States. It's not that expensive. We've got a lot of good experiments out there, and I'll make no bones about it. I come from the progressive left side of the spectrum, so I can see what websites like Alternet have done. I can see what things like Common Dreams have done. But we don't have an Oh My News yet in the United States, and we need it. So I am very enthusiastic when I hear people here talking about really helping to promote, flower, teach, and grow independent journalism. Because one of the really cool things about journalism now is citizen journalism. And it goes hand in hand with media literacy and understanding. And that's most what we need in a healthy democracy, is sharp, skeptical, media literate people who can not only consume media, but can produce it. I put our two websites up here, prwatch.org and sourcewatch.org. Sourcewatch.org is a media wiki. And if you go to that website, you will see that you can not only read thousands of articles reporting on lobbyists, PR firms, front groups, the people, and issues shaping the public agenda, but you can actually add information. You can create articles. You can edit them. We have a full-time editor, and we're about to add another one next month, who vet that information. It's like Wikipedia, except we use it for collaborative investigative reporting. And if you now Google Ahmed Chalabi or the Lincoln Group, the PR firm that's planning fake news for the army in Iraq, or if you Google Gina Colada, the top science reporter for the New York Times, the hits you're going to get, DP World, Dubai Port World, are going to be in the top five articles on Sourcewatch. I mean, this is an experiment in citizen journalism that we just started 3 weeks ago and has been tremendously successful. So let me just wrap up by saying we've got a sign-up sheet for our own weekly listserv. It's easy to get off of. I encourage you to sign up for it. We also have some information to pass out. I'll be happy to entertain any questions. And sorry, I've rambled on so long. I should have gone to questions sooner. Thank you.
John Stauber, director of the Center for Media and Democracy, speaking last month at Ithaca College. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, WRFN Nashville, KRBS Oroville, The Surge 96.3, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, or WMRW Warren. His talk was followed by questions from the audience, which were off mic, so I'll paraphrase them for you. The first questioner asked Stauber what role he saw for blogging.
Yeah, and public relations firms have moved big into blogging, too. If you go to an article on blogs at Sourcewatch, go to Sourcewatch and search for blogs, you'll see our article on this. I mean, the blogs have been recognized as an incredibly important source of information and opinion. And so the mainstream media is trying to figure out where to go. I mean, readership of newspapers is plummeting, and yet readership of their online sites is climbing. Clearly, the web is the present and the future. Whether you're CNN, whether you're, you know, somebody in this room, or whether whoever you are. So you're going to see, I think, just more and more flowering of online sites. And a lot of what's online is garbage, you know. And that's why it's really important to develop the same skepticism and critical thinking and media literacy tools to evaluate what's available online as it is to evaluate things you read or programs you watch. Our criteria for our Sourcewatch site is that any information put up there is supposed to be accurate, it's supposed to be fair, and we want documentation. If it's opinion, if it's rumor, it gets moved on to talk pages. I think that it's really important for more and more people who are moving into online journalism to try to establish standards of accurate and fair reporting. Dan Gilmore, who used to be with the San Jose Mercury News and has written a book, I think it's is it We the Media, or anyway, on citizen journalism, is sort of in the forefront of this. But there's a whole citizen journalism movement. And, you know, I think we need to self-impose and develop our own journalistic standards that will improve the quality of information online. You two folks back there.
What is being done to prevent the internet from being controlled the way other media is?
Well, I would urge people to go to the Free Press Organization's website, freepress.net. One of the most exciting political developments in the United States over the last few years has been the media becoming a political issue and people across the political spectrum actually organizing to try to secure and expand our rights to information and to express ourselves online. And that's one of the most important political fights, I think, in the years ahead. And I think all you have to do is look at China. You know, look at how companies like Yahoo, Google, and the others are cutting deals with China to provide censorship in China. You know, you can find plenty of pornography, I understand, online in China. But if you try to search for democracy online in China, that's where the 30,000 people employed by the Chinese government to censor and catch you come in. And that's the articles you can't find. And I don't see anything that is going to guarantee that this wonderful open access that currently exists online is going to continue or expand unless we organize and fight for it. And so I would just say go to freepress.net and sign up to be part of that battle. I guarantee you when we, for instance, break our study next month on the extent to which fake news is aired by commercial networks and TV stations in the United States, you're not going to see that on TV news. Or if you do, you're going to see the head of the radio TV news directors interviewed poo-pooing it and saying, see, it's just a tiny problem, just as we thought.
A question about a new PR technique.
Well, I haven't read Malcolm Gladwell's book, Tipping Point, but this sort of guerrilla marketing is widespread. It's been widespread for a long time. Actually enlisting people in marketing campaigns. It's especially used to target young people who tend to be skeptical of traditional commercials, but have actually shown to be rather susceptible to guerrilla campaigns under the radar that seem to be sort of spontaneous uprisings of people who really think Pepsi is better than Coke. If you, again, go to our website and, you know, Google terms like guerrilla marketing, you'll find articles with lots of links about the specifics of that. And it's very insidious. As John Hockheimer said, you know, it's educated people who are most susceptible to propaganda because we're the ones who think we're not. And it's really in, you know, open societies where the hidden persuaders function. And if you think you're too smart to be fooled, forget it. These are really smart, competent, capable people. And they know how to manage perception, and they make a lot of money doing that. Sure, they can look foolish. They can make a lot of mistakes. But, you know, it works.
Doesn't PR succeed partly because the audience doesn't want to hear the truth? How do you get people to want to hear the truth?
Well, you know, actually, you're absolutely right. For instance, in Trust Us, We're Experts, we look at how public relations campaigns push experts forward. And they have experts, for instance, here's an example. We have a chapter in that book titled Global Warming is Good for You. And we weren't just ripping off our previous book title. We looked at how there's an organization called the Greening Earth Society with real environmental scientists in it who go on talk shows, who put out videos, who publish papers saying that, well, it does appear that carbon dioxide is increasing in the atmosphere and that this could change the climate. But the good news is it's great news because more carbon dioxide, more green plant growth, you know, more global warming. We're going to be growing peaches in Ithaca in November. And, you know, does this work? Yeah, actually it works quite a bit because if you're driving down the highway listening to your local PBS radio show and here's an intelligent-sounding, credentialed environmental scientist with something called the Greening Earth Society telling you this, you're like, oh, thank God, I can, you know, fill it up. I think I'll get the SUV. And they're just hoping that the talk show host doesn't say, where does your money come from? And they have to say, well, we get 100% of our money from the coal industry, which is the case. You know, we would all like to hear that we can eat lots of fat food, we can smoke cigarettes, we can drive our SUVs, you know, all this other stuff, and it's not going to negatively impact us. And there's this whole area of public relations that's into providing messages. I want to say, that in terms of messages, I meant to mention it when I was talking about the war, that a week ago there was a survey that came out looking at opinions of U.S. military in Iraq. And it was by Zogby, who's an identified, you know, liberal pollster. And one of the questions in that survey asked U.S. soldiers in Iraq, why are we in Iraq? And 85% of the U.S. soldiers in Iraq said, we're in here to avenge 9/11 because Saddam did 9/11. And I think that's really important. And I think one thing that is a human tendency is once you believe something and you commit to that belief, you tend to hold on to it and not let go of it. And one thing this administration did so effectively through lots and lots of insinuation and the failure of the media to debunk it was plant in the minds of the American people that Saddam did 9/11. And in fact, I think right up through the last presidential election, a majority of Americans, definitely a majority of Americans who voted for Bush, believed that Saddam did 9/11. And psychiatrists will tell you, and good marketers will tell you, that if you can get people to bite and believe something, it's really hard to shake that loose. So it's sort of your question reminded me of that sad fact. And, of course, even the administration in its more honest moments is forced to admit that Saddam had nothing to do with 9/11.
Why don't news organizations blow the whistle on video news releases?
Here's what's going on. You know, TV is the worst sort of journalism. It's expensive to produce TV news, very expensive, and they're very dependent on corporate advertisers. Here's why video news releases, fake news, is so appealing to them. Because if you go out in the community and you do a news story, it's going to cost you thousands and thousands of dollars. You have to have a real journalist who knows how to investigate and produce a TV news story on your staff. If instead of doing real TV journalism, you're taking video news releases, you can lay off your journalists. You don't need them. You can just hire people right out of college who can edit film. And you can pick and choose from the daily feed of video news releases what you want to use to fill what's called the news hole. And here's what you get. You get to save thousands and thousands of dollars. You don't anger your advertisers because these video news releases are coming from the same corporations for the most part, and to a lesser extent government agencies, but the same corporations that are your advertisers. You don't get people calling up and saying, what happened to the news? Because you're airing very high production, compelling stuff. And that's why you keep the dirty little secret that this is plagiarism, this is fake news, and you don't label it. The PR people say, hey, don't blame us. We're PR people, and we tell them that this is from, you know, the Burson Marsteller public relations firm on behalf of, you know, Pfizer or Upjohn or General Motors. And that's true, they do. The real ethical crime here is being committed by the so-called TV journalists and news producers, and they do it for the bottom line because this stuff doesn't require journalism. So it maintains this myth of journalism. And, in fact, some of the people in the business of producing video news releases say, you know, we've done studies showing that if it's labeled, provided by the Burson Marsteller company on behalf of Ford Motors, it really still works well in affecting public opinion. You know, so we, you know,